But if you remember some of the things we talked about last week, you know, how to identify transitions, where scenes divide, looking at scenes as part of episodes and trying to figure out how they fit together to shape the plot. We have a really, really fantastic opportunity here in chapter 5, which is really brief, to see some of that going on, but then also to see how chapter 5 is part of this larger episode in the narrative of Samuel. So if you have those questions, if you would mind, just getting those out and having those next to you, and maybe thinking about some of those as we read. And why don't we read 1 Samuel chapter 5 together. If you remember in chapter 4, the Israelites thought it was this brilliant idea to take the ark with them into battle to kind of leverage Yahweh to win on their behalf. And Yahweh let his ark be captured instead. And so Israel is defeated and the Philistines have the ark. The glory has departed from Israel. And then we start chapter 5. When the Philistines captured the ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. That's a good 40 or so miles. That's a long way into Philistine territory. They've bypassed a couple of cities along the way because of where they're bringing it. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. And they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the Ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought around to us the Ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people." They sent, therefore, and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and said, "Send away the Ark of the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors. Then the cry of the city went up to heaven. What do you notice as we read that? Just some initial observations. Are Israelites part of the story at this point? No. The Israelites are gone, right? This is in the book of Samuel, which we know from reading previously is about the rise of kingship in Israel, and if anything, is really about David, although it's called Samuel. But as we've been reading, right, Eli has been a major character, and then he's just died as we left chapter 4. Samuel has been on the rise, so we would expect something to do with him. But Samuel's nowhere in this chapter. It's kind of weird. So what else do you notice? So no Israelites. Yeah, a few named characters. What else do we notice? Is this something that takes place on a day? Right? Chapter 4 took place essentially on one day, maybe two, back-to-back battles. Right? What about chapter 5? Yeah. Yeah. Long period of time. This is kind of like in the movies when the soundtrack swells and they show somebody coming through at different ages and little snippets of their life along the way. What else do you notice? Three cities are mentioned. Yeah, which ones? Ashdod, obviously, that's where they go first. Ekron. Gath. Those are three of the five leading cities of the Philistines. Okay. And they kind of stand in for all the others, right? At the end of the chapter, all of the Philistines are coming together. Right? Well, verse 8, so they send and gather together all the lords of the Philistines to see what they should do. And then as we get into chapter 6, when they make images of things to offer as offerings, they make five of them, right? Because there are five leading cities, so apparently all of the Philistines have been affected, although only these three are mentioned in this chapter. How would we divide this chapter into scenes if we were to do that? Is there a major break in the chapter, maybe in the pace at which things happen? Yeah, so from verses 1 to 5, that takes place in a relatively short time. And then verses 6 all the way to the end, and goes to verse 12, that takes place over a much longer period. We'll zero in on those first five verses. What do we have going on there? Could someone reread that for us? I can if you want. This is I think this is one of the most hilarious chapters in the whole Bible. And we should chuckle when we read it. Because Dagon is being made fun of, as well as being defeated. Steve, were you? Okay, yeah, if you don't mind. Okay. Think about any comment, any verse, any chapter you've ever read in the Old Testament and what it says about idols. What's going on in this section? Think about Isaiah 40 to 55. Right, this idea that a man goes and cuts down a tree and with half of it he throws into the fire. And half of it, he fashions this beautiful idol that he bows down to and worships. Look at how Dagon is described. There's a sense in which this begins very early. They have to bring the Ark of God into Dagon's temple to symbolize sort of Dagon's defeat, or in 1 Samuel chapter 5. But the Ark of the Lord is there as like a trophy of war, right? Look, Dagon has defeated the God of the Israelites. And here's this token that belongs to the God of the Israelites that we have. And that's a symbol that our God has won. And what happens overnight? Yeah, Dagon falls. Now if you look at verse 3, right? They're confused. Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. That's really unsettling if you're a Philistine. But maybe there was an earthquake. Right? Maybe there was a strong wind. Maybe this was an accident. Apparently Dagon wasn't nailed down. Maybe that was an oversight. Right? This tells you something also about the relative size of this statue of Dagon and of the Ark. I hadn't thought about this previously, until I read a commentator who pointed it out. But in the next verse, right, he ends up on the threshold next time he falls over. In order for that to happen, the statue of Dagon has to be at least as tall as his temple is wide. We're talking about a massive statue and this little ark. I mean, little being a little bit bigger than that table, right? But compared to this statue that can fall and end up with its head on the threshold, right? Yeah, yeah. So this is a massive statue that looks like he's bowing down in worship to the Ark of the God of Israel. Or is he bowing down in defeat? Or did he just fall over? Maybe it's interesting. There's several things, like the fact that they're not sure and they just put him back upright makes you wonder if this is a common thing, that their idols fall over and they have to put them back up. But it's dripping with ridicule the way it describes them there. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. This is the symbol of their God, that they're having to themselves place upright, the emphasis on that self-made idol. Right? But then what happens? What happens? Verse 4. They rose early the next morning. Behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. Right? Like we saw before, except what else has happened? Yeah. He's been beheaded. Right? And his hands, symbols of power, right? His hands are cut off. And in case we don't get the significance of the hands being cut off, right? What does it say in verse 6 about the Lord? The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod. So Dagon, this idol of theirs that they had to set up themselves, has been shown to be powerless. He's been defeated, right? The Philistines thought that Dagon had won. And so now the Lord, without the help of the Israelites, has seen to it to have his ark carried deep into Philistine territory, where he can defeat Dagon in Dagon's own temple. And he's going to continue this campaign against the Philistines as they move the ark around from city to city. Like, oh no, don't bring it here. Don't bring it here. We know what happened in the last city where you had it, right? So the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory, right? So they say, we can't keep it here. Let's send it off somewhere. Let's take it to Gath. So they take it to Gath, and things are bad there. So they send it to Ekron, and Ekron's like, no, not here, not here. For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. And then again, the hand of God was very heavy there. Verse 11. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so when he falls down first, it's ambiguous, right? Is this, did he just fall down because of a gust of wind or something? Is he falling down in obeisance or worship or servitude? Or is he falling down dead? We're not sure. And so it's hilarious the way they set him back up. How many people would that have taken, right, to raise up their own God? Right? And then the next day, yeah, all the ambiguity has been taken away. And the Lord has defeated Dagon, whose head and hands have been cut off. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent question. How ambiguous could it have been, actually, the first time he falls over? The Philistines are very interesting along this line. We see this with the way they decide to return the ark. It's like they're used to having things happen that they can't explain. And so they'll do things a second time to confirm that it's what they thought it was. Yeah, you get those pairs of things. The statue falls over, so they set him up. And when he falls over again, their worst fears are confirmed, right? When they get ready to send the ark back, they set it up in a certain way so that they can know, right? Okay, did this just happen to us by chance? Like, maybe they're still hoping that all of this has just been by chance, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all kinds of comments we could get into along those lines, right? Without a Christian worldview, you go to great lengths to try and explain the world as you experience it and as you see it, without having the key that unlocks and integrates your knowledge, right? Yeah, hoping it could be something other than what really you know it is. Yeah. It's a mockery of idol worship all over the world in this chapter.
So.
Yeah. And Dagon is shown to be, right, unable to keep his own statue from falling over. Unable to avenge what's been done to his image, right? And unable to protect his people from this wooden crate plated in gold that gets carried around from city to city, right? So Dagon is shown to be a false god who has no power here in what should be, right, the place where he has the home field advantage, right? Not just his own territory, but even in his own house. So. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody leaves the battle in chapter 4 thinking it must be that Dagon has overcome the Lord. And we get into chapter 5 and we see, well, that's not the case at all. But that does very much sharpen the question, why has the Lord allowed the Israelites to be defeated? Because clearly, right, if he can defeat the Philistines without an Israelite army, just all by himself, then he could have delivered the Israelites, but did not do so. Chose not to do so. It's a terrifying thing to consider. It's not that God was sleeping or unable to stop what happened. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're accustomed to seeing God working through people as His instruments. And here that's not so. He's acting on His own. So.
This ark is making its circuit here. Mm-hmm. Five cities there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering collectively, is God trying to send a huge message about, I guess, maybe two things: worshiping Him with Him alone and not having any other gods, and then as far as how to worship God, like handling of the ark.
Mm-hmm.
Handling of the ark, Lord, I think there was mishandling of the ark along the way.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. It strikes me as I read these two chapters, chapter 5 and chapter 6, that the Lord deals with the Philistines in a sense with much more latitude than He deals with the Israelites. The Philistines put the ark on a cart and just let it go, pulled by these bulls, or by the cows, sorry. And He seems to just kind of let that go, having done all of this already. I mean, it's not as though He gives the Philistines a pass for their idol worship, right? But the ark of the Lord has gone on this campaign against the Philistines. He's defeated them, and they send the ark back with these offerings. But when it gets back into Israelite territory, and some guys get this brilliant idea to take a peek in the ark, right? They're slaughtered on the site. It's very interesting. I'm not entirely sure what to make of it. I didn't get that far in the commentary this week. But I wonder if, well, we get an indication there. Not that the Philistines are not accountable for things. I don't think we get that at all. But the Israelites are held to a higher standard because they have greater understanding and greater knowledge. Yeah. So, should we dive into chapter 6? Or keep going? Oh, Charity. Yeah, only the Levites are supposed to carry the ark around, and there aren't any Levites among the Philistines. So, I don't know. The ark seems to have successfully made it from one city to another. They aren't, so the Philistines who carry it or move it aren't struck dead on the spot, apparently. So we're not really able to answer that question. So, yeah, that's part of what I mean, and that there seems to be more allowance for the Philistines who would not have known how to treat the ark of God properly than there is for the Israelites who should have known. Shall I proceed into chapter 6? Yeah, all right. So the first half of chapter 5, the Lord defeats Dagon in His own temple. The second half of chapter 5, He's gone on this campaign against the Philistine cities. So chapter 6, the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place." They said, "If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you." And they said, "What is the guilt offering that we shall return to him?" They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. A couple of observations there. This whole affair has only taken 7 months. If you think about ancient warfare, you think about that there were 5 cities and their surrounding territories, and the Lord has utterly defeated the entire Philistine people in 7 months without an army. I think that's significant. Yeah, with no battle. No besieging. They're utterly destroyed in that time period. Years. I would expect normally, especially for a relative military powerhouse in the region to be defeated by merely human means, I would have expected that would take years. And the Lord's done that in 7 months. So, and note that the language has shifted slightly with reference to plagues. There are several references along this back to the Exodus. So, and we have 5 now for all 5 cities, even though only 3 were discussed in the previous chapter. And we get mice as well as tumors, perhaps as those associated with carrying the plague, or perhaps because of a plague of mice that's not expressly mentioned earlier. So, you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land. This is verse 5. And give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. Again, a reference to hand after Dagon's hands have been cut off. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he had dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away? And they departed. Again, as we saw earlier, even as far back as chapter 4, the Philistines seem to have learned something about the Exodus and Israel's time in Egypt. Things that Israel maybe hasn't learned as much from. So, although for the Philistines to have heard about it, right? Other people are talking. So, now then, take and prepare a new cart and 2 milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home, away from them. This is like setting Dagon up the second time, right? They're putting things in place to try and discern, to divine, as it were, whether this is a divine action or whether this is all chance. And so they're setting things up in such a way that, of course, this won't work unless it's the hand of the Lord, right? They're taking cows that have never pulled a cart to pull this cart, right? Cows that have calves that are nursing, right? They want their calves, so they're going to turn and go back to their calves, right? And take the ark of the Lord, verse 8, and place it on the cart, and put in a box at its side the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way. And watch, if it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. Another reference to hand. So, and as Charity mentioned, right, this is not the way the ark is supposed to be carried, right? But the Lord doesn't strike them dead for putting it on a cart, right? He lets this play out. The men did so, and took 2 milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrificed sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. It's like VP day for the ark of the Lord, victory over the Philistines. And now the ark is back and there's this great celebration. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, and one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages. The great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. So, five tumors, but mice for all the villages that belong to those cities as well. Then verse 19. Everything seems like it's going great. And then with no warning, right? Verse 19. And he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up away from us?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you." What do we do with that ending to this chapter? What do you notice as you read it? He is. So he's holding them accountable for how they're treating the ark. It's a good question. What was the sin? What was the sin in what they do? I think there are some clues in the way things are worded from 19 to 21. Look at what they say. And who does it remind you of? I don't think we're going to get a specific answer, but I think we get a characterization here. For me, some of what they say in reaction reminds me of the Philistines. Right? Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? Right? Where are we going to send it to be away from us? Looking for the particular language. Back in chapter 5, a little bit in chapter 6. But also, it seems to me that the Israelites here haven't learned anything from the last two chapters. They treated the Ark of God lightly in chapter 4. And they're treating it lightly here at the end of chapter 6. And so they're struck down. It's interesting that the Philistines don't treat it lightly. They don't know how to treat it rightly. But they don't treat it lightly. They don't have the revelation that describes for them proper reverence and how it's to be handled. But they treat it in a way the Israelites don't.
Humility or something, and first they celebrate it, then they mistreat it, and then they have to get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the ark has come back from this campaign against the Philistines, and now it's continuing its campaign against us. We got to move it somewhere else. So.
Separated it from God.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's as though the ark has not come back by chance. Yeah, while it's among the Philistines, I mean, it comes back with these offerings, and the lords of the Philistines come all the way to the edge. So I'm sure they see people they recognize as Philistines and probably boss Philistines. Bringing it, although not coming, so we don't get a description of envoys going between them or anything like that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, or the force to be reckoned with. Yeah. Yahweh is God and Dagon is not.
Mm-hmm. Like, why is that place? I mean, is that just the nearest place, and then she says it there, or it seems like it should be going to a specific place.
Yeah, like why not back to Shiloh?
Right.
Let's see if we've got where these places are. So Kiriath and Jearim. Is uphill and further in from Beth Shemesh. If you have one of the ESV Bibles that has those maps in the back, the 12 tribes of Israel map is helpful. If you look at E3, you see Benjamin in the middle. Gibeah is kind of on the southern border of Benjamin in the middle. From west to east. Kiriath Jearim is a little bit west of Gibeah. And Beth Shemesh is west-southwest of Kiriath Jearim. So Kiriath Jearim is further in toward the highlands, away from the coastal plain. So it would have been uphill. But why there as opposed to somewhere else? I don't know. It is vaguely in the direction of Shiloh, but Shiloh's much further north in Ephraim. So. So how does this fit into the larger story of Samuel? What have we seen so far? Right in chapter 1, you can look, it's not cheating. What do we see in chapter 1? Right, in chapter 1, we're introduced to Eli and to Samuel. We're not introduced to Samuel yet. We know that, I guess by the end of the chapter we are. Right? We see Hannah coming. So we see Hannah, we see Eli, and then Samuel is born and then dedicated. Yep, answered prayer. We see also, we get little inklings of the failure of leadership there in chapter 1, right? Although we also see the faithfulness of a family, right? So we have this interesting tension in these early chapters of Samuel between like little windows on Israelite families who are faithful in their worship and faithful in obeying the Lord's commands against national failures. Failure of Eli in his position as a leader and his sons. But also failure in his family to deal with his sons. And then we also see later in chapter 4 the failure of the nation. Right? So there's this tension between faithfulness and faithlessness, or faithfulness and failure. In chapter 2, we get Hannah's prayer. Which clues us into a lot of what's coming. We get our first mention of a king there. We get Eli's sons. And the rejection of Eli and his household, right? From this nameless, this anonymous man of God. In chapter 3, we get the call of Samuel. In that chapter that's full of all of these puns on Eli's lack of sight and the vision that comes to Samuel in the midst of that. And we're left at the end of chapter 3 with this kind of implicit question: is Samuel a new Moses? Is he the one like Moses that God will raise up among your, from among your brothers? So in chapter 4, we have the loss of the ark, the death of Eli. And the glory departs. Right? So how do 5 and 6 fit into that larger picture? As we move towards 7 and 8, right? Chapter 8 is where the people will demand that Samuel give them a king. And Samuel tries to set up a dynasty along the way. We'll see more of that when we get there. I reckon part of what we see in these chapters is we see that the Lord is at work. He's at work all over the world. He's at work at times when it doesn't look like it. Right? That his interest is wider than the boundaries of Israel. Right? Maybe we'll leave it with questions we'll come back to think about how does this fit in as we get further. It's okay to do that, right? As you read, it's especially helpful to write down unresolved questions that you have and then look back at them as you've read more. If you're reading through Genesis, right, chapter 38 doesn't make much sense following chapter 37. And it's going to be a few chapters before it does, right? Why do we interrupt this cycle of stories about Joseph with this story about Judah? It doesn't make any sense until we get toward the end. And Judah suddenly takes on this role that, without chapter 8, seems like he's completely unprepared for. That also explains the blessing he gets in chapter 49, right? 38 sets us up for that, but 38 doesn't make sense until we get there. So let's keep these chapters in mind as we keep reading. All right. Thank you.